Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We're here today with Father Michael Roach, continuing our conversation on the Archbishops of Baltimore. Father Roach, thanks for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
So we're here to talk about a personal favorite of yours, Archbishop Michael Curley, who's in a tough spot from the get-go because he follows, arguably the most popular Catholic statesman in all of the United States, let alone the longest-serving archbishop in Baltimore. That couldn't have been easy.
No, and it was a great surprise to him, too. He wasn't a man who sought ecclesiastical preferment at all, quite the contrary. He was a missionary in Florida when he was named Bishop of St. Augustine, and it was quite surprising that he was named Archbishop of Baltimore, the youngest archbishop in the country. No one could figure it out. They were expecting John Russell, a Baltimorean, Bishop of Charleston, to get the nod, but he wasn't in the best health. So Rome named this young, vigorous bishop from Florida. Probably his youth was one of the motivations, because Cardinal Gibbons was so very old, in his late 80s by the time he went home to God in 1921.
To understand Michael Curley is to understand his personality, and he had a strong personality. Wonder if we can figure out how that personality kind of came to be. Are there things about his background, his upbringing, his youth, his family situation that helps us understand the strong personality that he would develop?
Right. He was a tough Irishman from Athlone, as a matter of fact, and had a fine education. And was a fine student, won a lot of awards in the studies and the like. He was an idealist. He had wanted to be a missionary, and his first thought was to be a missionary, in the South Pacific. But the Bishop of St. Augustine came to his seminary and gave a talk on the American missions, and that really put him on fire, and he signed up to come to St. Augustine, which was desperately poor at the time. After ordination in his first parish, he said his first collection was 33 cents. So he took to growing orange trees to make some money for the church, as a matter of fact.
So he was industrious on top of being...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A real go-getter, no question about it.
So, and you alluded to that, so this young priest is... thrust into the limelight, into the premiercy, follows the lion that was Cardinal James Gibbons. What was it about his preparation that you think people liked most about him when it came to succeeding Gibbons?
He was a great talker. I mean, I can remember in my childhood people still quoting Michael Curley 20, 30 years later after they had heard him speak. He had a great turn of phrase and a powerful man, a powerful orator.
There's a great picture of him in Washington, I believe, for the inauguration of Calvin Coolidge. He's standing up on the dais, and animated and full of passion in his speaking.
He really was. The sad thing was his health betrayed him in later years. His sight was gone, several other things. But he was a wonderful presence, very unafraid. He would take on anyone from the president down in his speeches and his sermons.
Right is right.
That's it. That is it.
He was unlike Gibbons to the extent that, and he makes this clear in a famous exchange with a wealthy donor in the Archdiocese who sees him at an event and invites him to, some estate. And he says, I didn't come here to be the the bishop of the Catholic wealthy or something.
Absolutely. John Tracy Ellis loved to tell that story, and he would name the family, as a matter of fact. I hope you will come and spend time with us, as Cardinal Gibbons always did. And he said, I have not come to Baltimore to be the Archbishop for the Catholic rich, and turned around and walked away. So he could be a little truculent sometimes. And Monsignor Ellis also said, you can always have an exchange with your priest and say anything you want, but you don't put it in print. And he wrote to one very poor pastor, Father, once again, you have shown you have the administrative ability of a 7-year-old girl. So he was very candid, to say the least.
Does that speak to his administrative style, his personality, maybe both? And what was his overall relationship like with the priests?
I think they respected him. But the ones I knew as a child who still spoke of him, spoke very highly of him. He was tough, but fair.
What were the kind of the challenges of his day? What was the Archdiocese of Baltimore as a local church? What were the challenges that, that it faced that he really had to contend with?
Well, the Depression, for one thing, that was a terrible thing in Baltimore. Washington didn't feel it so much, but Baltimore did. And several things he wouldn't do. For example, the money had been left for the building of a new cathedral. And he said, on the whole, I would prefer building a 4-room schoolhouse for poor black children than I would building a new cathedral. So he put that off for a while. Had a great love for the poor and was personally very, very poor. When he died, he had one suit to his name, and they had to send over to Catholic U to get the ritual for a bishop because he had given his way to a visiting African bishop. It is said that when the Cathedraticum in those days came in March, he'd given it away to the poor by July. So a grand heart. Everyone who writes about him talks about his great personal poverty.
So he for sure would have been loved by Pope Francis.
Oh, I think in that regard, for sure. For sure.
Though probably lacked the diplomacy that...
And no fear of controversy either.
For sure.
When he died, the Archbishop of Cincinnati, a Dominican McNicholas, with whom he'd had many battles, said the best thing about Curley. He said, he was the warrior prelate and the almoner of the poor. Warrior prelate and the almoner of the poor. Nice way to be remembered as a bishop.
Absolutely. So he was also a big believer in education and helped the establishment of archdiocesan high schools, making that a priority.
Absolutely. And the great story, of course, is when he built Catholic High, they brought in the incorporation papers and had Curley called it the Curley High. He put a line through it and said, Catholic, not Curley. So he wasn't into it for his own aggrandizement.
So the school was originally to be named Curley High.
Because later on they named the school down the street.
Across, that's right.
Archbishop Curley. But in his day, I think we reached close to the highest number of Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Washington and Baltimore. I think there were 159 Catholic schools. He had a great love for the rural schools, too, the country schools. He saw that even poor communities out in the counties should have at least a small Catholic school.
So during, you mentioned the Archdiocese of Washington, which is created during his episcopacy, and in fact he's named coadjutor or?
He's the only bishop at the church that I'm had multiple dioceses.
So how does the Archdiocese of Washington come about, and what does that kind of mean for the future of our archdiocese?
But it had to be because Washington was growing so great and the suburbs also. He didn't like Washington. He thought there were too many church politics as well. He was addressing the priests there once and said, my independence is worth a lot more than a cup of tea, so you men stay away from those embassies and the like. It's a story we love to tell to Washington people to this day.
That must have been a challenge, though. I mean, running two archdioceses.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine.
No, he had two chanceries, as a matter of fact. He generally lived at St. Patrick's in Washington when he was over there. But I don't think he was ever comfortable in Washington. Some would say, the psycho-historians would say, it was because he was threatened and insecure around wealth and power.
And how does it all come to an end for him? What are the circumstances?
Yes, in Bon Secours Hospital. I even know a story about that. He was at Bon Secours where he loved to go, and he ran into someone, a doctor, and he said, my daughter Octavia is getting married. He said, I will marry her. So they'd change all their plans and have the Archbishop come to St. Ignatius and marry Octavia Chatard. So great stories about him. One time a nun was running down the steps. He said, sister, where are you going? She said, someone is dying. I must get a priest. He said, I'm a priest. I'm an archbishop, but I'm also a priest. He went and did the anointing.
Oh.
So
always on the job and always willing to lend a hand.
Always the priest.
And he's said to also, because of his temper, has gotten into more than a couple squabbles with the Baltimore Sun at the time.
Oh, my. Oh, yes, yes. Columnists had compared Ignatius Loyola to Adolf Hitler. And Michael Curley called all the Catholic advertising out of the Sun papers. Now, finally, a truce was negotiated with the help of H.L. Mencken, as a matter of fact, while the Archbishop was away in Ireland for his summer vacation. And it was resolved. But that's a very famous story. He also got into the Jesuits over a fortune that had been left to them that was supposed to go to the diocese, the Stewart case.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I mean, it was quite the rain. People were telling Curley stories well into the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and we're fortunate that they're still being told, I think.
Oh, I think.
So the final word on Michael Curley?
Well, I don't think I could beat the warrior prelate and the almoner of the poor.
That's what I was thinking, too. Father Michael Roach speaking to us today about the legacy in the episcopacy of Archbishop Michael Curley. Thanks very much for being with us.
Surely.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. From kindergarten through 12th grade, students of St. Mary's Elementary School and St. Mary's High School in Annapolis are receiving a cutting-edge education. Last winter, the elementary school, which has approximately 800 students, was certified as the first Common Sense Digital Citizenship School in Maryland for its courses on the benefits and responsibilities of Internet use. St. Mary's High School, meanwhile, is implementing the St. Isidore Cyber Program, which aims to give the approximately 475 students in grades 9 through 12 an education that combines science, mathematics, and other tech-related subjects within the humanities. Cyber is so prevalent right now, and we have to make this a part of their opportunities at St. Mary's, said Connie Coker, the Director of Technology for grades K through 12 at St. Mary's. It is not only consuming technology, but really producing and creating with the technology and the skills they're learning. Learn more at CatholicReview.org. The U.S. Bishops Migration and Refugee Services is receiving a $1.25 million grant from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, to aid in its refugee resettlement efforts once the newcomers arrive in the United States. The Mormons have refugee processing capabilities overseas, according to Bill Canny, Executive Director of Migration and Refugee Services, but they do not offer domestic resettlement services. This is the first time in memory that the Mormons have made such a gift to an agency within the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, although the Baltimore-based Catholic Relief Services, the U.S. Bishops Overseas Aid and Development Organization, has received grants from the Mormons dating to the Ethiopian famine more than 30 years ago. For more information on this story and others, visit CatholicReview.org. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is George Matisek.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the church full-time, The Catholic Review. Pick up the print magazine monthly at your parish or have The Catholic Review delivered to your home every month. You can get fresh news every day online at CatholicReview.org. Subscribe to the Catholic Review e-newsletter for twice-a-week updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Find our app on Apple and Android, and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print and online, at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We continue today with our discussion with Father Michael Roach of the Archbishops of Baltimore. And today we have the privilege of chatting about Francis Patrick Keough, who served as Archbishop of Baltimore from 1947 to 1961. Father Roach, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
So Archbishop Keogh comes to us from Providence, where he had served as bishop prior to joining the Archdiocese of Baltimore. What do we know about his early life and his early ministry?
Right. He was from Connecticut, actually, and named Bishop of Providence, Rhode Island. His great accomplishment in Providence was calming down the terrible rivalry between the French and the Irish components of his diocese. It had gotten so bad that some of the French independents had been excommunicated. He brought great peace to that, had respect for both communities, the Irish and the French, and as a matter of fact, wound up sending a lot of his seminaries to France to study, to prepare them to deal equally with the French and the Irish populations in that state. It was a very dreadful time before he got there. He settled things down.
So he is a moderator, a mediator.
Indeed, a peacemaker.
A peacemaker. Yes. What else do we know about him as a person?
Well, he also had a great heart for the young. He loved kids, and he put great stress on education. And the great pictures of Archbishop Keogh are him surrounded by kids, and they're all smiling delightedly mm-hmm. with him. And he was like a grandfather to
them.
He
did have kind of a grandfatherly countenance
absolutely,
about him.
Absolutely, he did.
So what do you think leads Rome or whomever decides that this man is going to be the next Archbishop of Baltimore?
Yeah, I'm told that part of the motivation was that he had been so strong in education and had actually been the chairman of the education committee of the bishops. And they knew that Baltimore, in the boom after the Second World War, needed many more schools.
Mm. So, in fact, the archdiocese itself grows by 52% during his time as archbishop, much of it in the suburbs. This is the time where we begin to see the exodus from the city. How did he help guide the diocese during this kind of time of growth and expansion?
Well, unfortunately, his health betrayed him, and he gets sick and spends the last few years of his life out at Stella Maris, the facility that he had built for the aged and infirm. In his early days, he had vigorous programs, but the last few years were a bit fading for him. So he didn't get to do everything he had wanted to do. He did, of course, build the charity institutions out in Delaney Valley, bought the estate at Long Crandon, mm-hmm. and began with an orphanage, a home for single mothers, and an infant home. He consolidated, did a lot of great work in Catholic charity. Baltimore had been so parish-centered. There were, at one time, I think, 21 different orphanages, many of which were centered in parishes. And he saw this was very inefficient, so he reorganized Catholic Charities and brought all the orphanages together out in Delaney Valley there.
Seems to speak to his administrative abilities and the fact that the church is buying up properties. He is said to have led the first real large-scale capital campaign, fundraising campaign. So this is a man with some vision and some
yes.
gravitas, I would imagine.
Yes. Someone told me that well into the 70s, we were still utilizing the lands that he had bought with a lot of foresight all over the diocese.
That's amazing. So the landscape of the archdiocese seems to change a great deal during this time as archbishop, from one that was Baltimore-centric to a more suburban one, as we referenced. So how did this shape his priorities? Are we seeing suburban schools, suburban parishes, just more of a suburban feel to what had been really an urban and a rural-centric diocese?
Right. There was great suburbanization in that time. You can see the growth of what were tiny country parishes to among the biggest parishes of the diocese. I think of the ones in Catonsville and Towson and the like that just boomed at that time. And he encouraged the pastors to build and build and build. And you see a colossal amount of facilities put up at that time.
So whereas his predecessor, Archbishop Curley, eschewed the opportunity to build a new cathedral, as it were, one does come about during the time of Francis Keogh.
Interesting. There's some urban legends about that. I'm not sure how true they are. One of which was if they weren't going to use that money soon, they were going to lose that money from the O'Neill estate, and he had to use at least 51% of that legacy for a new cathedral. There were those who said, why do we need a new cathedral? But we had the money. If we were going to get the rest of the $20 million, we were going to have to build this cathedral. And so he took the steps to do it, grand piece of land. A Boston architect, interestingly enough, certainly an interesting building, very controversial because it was so modern when it was opened, and 20 years later it was considered very archaic because of the changes in the church in that era.
In the style, and it was certainly far different from what had been the only cathedral in town, which was the Basilica of the Assumption.
Right. As some people have said that the new cathedral is the last breath of the Art Deco. Interestingly,
when do you think we'll stop calling it the new cathedral? I know that in my own childhood, that's all it was called, and I'm hearing it, but not quite as much.
I'm a standard bearer for the old cathedral and the new cathedral. Believe me,
distinguish it.
Yeah, I still call the airport Friendship, so you know.
So don't use you as a guide.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So, what was the relationship like between Archbishop Keough and his priests? Anything we know about that?
Well, as he faded. He, when he talked to the priest, as he would have done in Providence, he always called you Père in French. Well, Père, I think this. He was a gentle man, though. He really was a gentle man. And
he was not a priest of Baltimore, and nor did he go to the seminary here. Was that an obstacle at all, do you think, being a complete kind of foreigner, if you will, to the archdiocese?
Well, remember, only two of our archbishops were Baltimoreans in all of these years, and I think only two or three more were Marylanders, so we were rather accustomed to having bishops from different parts of the world. This one was particularly northern, though, coming from all the way from New England.
You mentioned that he was a gentleman, and I think it speaks to stories that his former assistant, Monsignor Bozell, told about how affable he was, and it would often take him 30 minutes just to get inside his residence because he would stop and talk to everybody he met. Right. He also mentions that he, kind of an ironic quirk about him was that he was scared to death to ride in the back seat of a car, which I think
that's amazing.
Kind of an interesting.
And Bobby Bozell was a great storyteller. He was always one of my great sources for oral history and a great priest, and he loved Archbishop Keough.
Yeah. You know. Well, and anyone who works close to an archbishop, if they develop that kind of a friendship and affinity for him, I think that's a pretty good indicator of the kind of man he must
absolutely
have been.
Absolutely tells the tale.
Yeah. So what's the final word on Francis Patrick Keough?
He did the best he could given his bad health, and we owe an awful lot to him in terms of building and Catholic charities in the archdiocese.
So a visionary and a skilled administrator.
Right.
It's Father Michael Roach speaking about Archbishop Francis Keough.
The season of sacraments is nearly here. First Holy Communion, Confirmation, and Weddings. Visit the Baltimore Basilica, America's first cathedral, and stop by the gift shop for all of your gift needs. From beautiful frames to crucifixes and crosses, statues and one-of-a-kind rosaries, the Basilica Gift Shop has it all. Friendly, knowledgeable staff members can help you select the perfect gift. Also available, Baltimore's very own Mouth Party Caramels, locally designed hand-painted signs and jewelry, plus gifts for Easter as well as an extensive line of St. Patrick's Day items sure to bring out the Irish in everyone. Visit the Basilica Gift Shop at 409 Cathedral Street in Baltimore or call 410-727-3565 for hours and directions. Free street parking available directly in front of the Basilica between 9:30 and 4 p.m.
Life can be hard, and at times we feel overwhelmed and alone. When faced with problems, know that there is a group of Catholics who are part of the prayer ministry of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, waiting to lift you and your needs to God in prayer. This ministry is comprised of men and women, young and old, religious and lay, from every ethnic and cultural background. They pray as individuals and in groups, in homes and meeting spaces throughout Baltimore. Like you, they are people who have suffered the same hurts, fears, pains, sickness, loss, and everyday burdens. Learn more about this ministry by visiting our website at www.archbalt.org. If you are in need of prayer, send your prayer request to prayers@archbalt.org or by phone to 410-547-5517. Would you like to volunteer to be a part of the ministry? Prayer ministers are always needed. Please call or email our coordinator, who would be happy to speak with you.
For 143 years, New Cathedral Cemetery has served the needs of the Catholic community of Baltimore and Central Maryland. New Cathedral is the only cemetery owned by the Archdiocese of Baltimore and is the final resting place for many religious orders and famous citizens. 125 acres of rolling hills, trees, and beautiful monuments, the cemetery is an oasis of peace and tranquility and is located off Edmondson Avenue just outside of Catonsville. New Cathedral is dedicated to the task of tending to the mortal remains of our dearly departed and has many more years of available space. If you are in need of a burial site, vault, monument, or marker, or just a respectful location to place your cremated loved ones, our counselors will help you through this process and make sure the wishes of you and your loved ones are honored. Visit us online at newcathedralcemetery.org, like us on Facebook at New Cathedral Cemetery Bonnie Bray, or call 410-566-7770.
For over 200 years, the Archdiocese of Baltimore's Catholic schools have welcomed families of all faiths, providing generations of students with an academically excellent value-based education taught in a Christ-centered environment. With a 99% graduation rate, the highest in the nation, and a 98% college attendance rate, Catholic school graduates are better prepared to succeed in college and beyond. But Catholic schools offer more than an education. They offer tradition, family, faith, and the opportunity for students to grow as individuals and as future leaders in their community. Discover these and other benefits of a Catholic school and learn more about why Catholic schools are an unparalleled value in education in the Baltimore region. Call 1-800-5-CATHOLIC or visit www.archbalt.org. Catholic schools, a place to grow.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.